This is a day like no other for Columbus. With the official dedication of the American Insurance Union Citadel, Columbus, Ohio now boasts the fifth tallest building in the world. But how could such a building come to Columbus? A city barely within the top 30 U.S. cities in terms of population. And what kind of man would build such a building?
You're listening to the soundtrack from a new documentary. It's called The Citadel, Birth of the Levesque Tower. The film will be screened at 7:30 p.m. on Wednesday, November 9th at the Drexel Theater. For more information, go to drexel.net or call 614-231-1050. Later on this hour, we're going to talk with a local architect who is working on major renovations at the Levesque. And also historian Ed Lentz will join us to talk about why the Levesque Tower remains the city's most iconic structure and perhaps how it affected other architecture in the city. Joining us now is Columbus filmmaker Seth Mockerman. He wrote and directed Citadel, Birth of the Levesque Tower. Seth has edited programs for the Discovery Channel, National Geographic, MTV, Lifetime, and Bravo. He co-produced and edited an award-winning sports documentary about Ted Ginn Jr. Welcome, Seth.
Thanks.
So, to our listeners, everybody knows what the Levesque Tower is. So what are your memories of the Levesque Tower? Do you think the Levesque Tower continues to be an important Columbus landmark? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The Levesque Tower has been around since 1927, so there's got to be some stories out there. Share them with us. 614-292-8513 is the number, or you can go online. You can join us on Facebook page. You can tweet at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Seth, what was the trigger for the documentary now?
Well, it wasn't really now. I've actually been working on it off and on for 7 years now. I think I started doing research on it in 2004.
So, what inspired you?
I was working at Channel 6 and local news, and after working there for a few years, I decided local news was not what I wanted to do. And it was just kind of one of these these random decisions where I'm like, well, I like documentaries. Maybe I should make one. And I had been shooting a wedding, which, is a good way to start out video here in Ohio. And I was shooting a wedding downtown in the Athenaeum, and I was walking around the building, and I was just fascinated by that building. And I started researching that building, and I couldn't find anything relating to it other than it used to be a Scottish Rite temple, which is some sort of Masonic offshoot. And, but in the course, every time I would do a search for Columbus building, the Levesque kept coming up. And it didn't have a whole lot of information about it. And it's funny because I hadn't even really thought about that building the entire, 10 years I'd been living in Columbus. It was just there. And I'm like, that's an interesting building. And started doing the research.
You never heard the joke about when you fly over Columbus?
No.
The flyover jokes?
No, uh-uh.
Oh, I worked in the Levesque Tower.
Sure.
But when I watched the documentary, I learned things about it, of course, that I didn't know just by working there. And it also made me think about how often I walked through there and never really looked at it.
Mm-hmm.
What amazed you or what inspired you while you were making the film? What surprised you?
I was just really surprised about the idea of what the building was supposed to be about. I'd spend very little time thinking about progressivism, that whole progressive movement. I didn't even really study a whole lot of American history before that. And just as I got into the story and I started reading about this guy and what he was doing, I learned about what the building was trying to – or what the company was trying to do.
My guest is Seth Mockerman. He is a Columbus filmmaker who wrote and directed Citadel, Birth of the Levesque Tower. That's what we're talking about today, the Levesque Tower. You have a memory you want to share with us about the Levesque Tower, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Right, the history behind the Levesque Tower becomes a very prominent part, and the history of the man behind the Levesque Tower becomes a very important part of the story. Let's listen to another clip from the documentary. At the dedication ceremony for the American Insurance Union Citadel, its original name, on September 21st, 1927, the building's architect, C. Howard Crane, praises John Jacob Lentz for his vision to build the skyscraper, which at the time was the fifth tallest building in the world.
Before I relinquish this building, I must tell you why we've been able to have such a beautiful and such a wonderful structure. Back of this job was John J. Lentz. He is truly a great man, a man of such vision, such high ideals, and capacity for work. I take great pleasure in formally presenting to you the keys to the Citadel, a symbol of the high and noble ideals of your great company.
That's not really C. Howard Crane, is it, Seth?
No, it's certainly not. It's Gabe Spiegel.
Okay. And John Jacob Lentz was no ordinary politician. He was not an ordinary business leader. You mentioned what his role was in the progressive movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was, you know, he was just kind of this do-gooding crusader. You know, he was all about all the progressive causes of the day. You know, he was a big supporter of prohibition, you know, the temperance movement. He was all about women's suffrage. You know, he campaigned against child welfare, you know, reform of labor laws. He was really big into monetary reform at the time. You know, there was the big he got into politics in 1896, which was the presidential election of William McKinley and William Jennings Bryan, when the key issue at the time was the free silver movement, which was just basically – it's funny because these same arguments are still going on. I mean, I'm sure people at the time were saying it was class warfare. You know, I think they had slightly different terminologies, but that's pretty much what was going on.
Yeah. I mean, but it was a very heated debate. And it made him think a lot about how people lived and how they survived and how the money system worked and also insurance. What was the trigger for him to get into insurance? There was some inequity, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, well, the one article I found that he was talking about, he said he was just basically sitting around reading an article one day and reading all the money that was being spent on insurance, for one, was not being kept here in Ohio. And that money was not going to the people, you know, that insurance protection wasn't going to the people that needed it most. You know, it was basically the wealthy could afford insurance and the poor could not. So he was, he was trying to come up with a way where everybody could have some sort of insurance protection.
So what was the American Insurance Union? What kind of company did he build?
It was, a fraternal society, which, they're hugely popular at the time.
Like a club?
Kind of. Like the Masons or the Knights of Columbus. You know, they were sort of this like social club / insurance company, which, I don't think there's really any examples today.
I don't think anyone thinks of social club / insurance.
No, certainly not. But they did all kinds of crazy things. Like they would go on group picnics and group retreats, and then they'd have rules where you could only, be a part of the union if you could read and write. You know, they really promoted those values, and they tried to support organizations that didn't support the saloon, didn't support drinking, that type of thing.
And they had delegates that represented the different constituencies around the country or around Ohio?
Yeah, there was chapters. I mean, it started here in Ohio and it spread across the country. I mean, it was a national company. Like the Secretary of Labor at the time, James Davis, I believe, he was a member. I think he was their most prominent national member. So he always like was flown in for every event. And it's big, here's our Secretary of Labor guy. So yeah, they definitely, it was a nationwide company.
Now, you really got into the history of that. The whole history of the insurance industry and where it came from. Why did you go so deeply into that regarding the building?
I think it just helped to explain what he was trying to do. I mean, it was also a part of I was learning the process as well. Like, I definitely would not imagine when I started working on this, I would be talking to insurance scholars and finding some insurance museum to send me artifacts. I just think it was necessary to tell the story, to put it in context.
Now, you did use a lot of documents and newspaper headlines. There wasn't really anybody left to talk about it who was there.
No. I mean, that was, I'd thought about trying, because I'm sure, and I've run into one or two people that was alive during that time, but they're, over 80. So, and it's for as much as,
Nothing against all of our over 80 listeners.
No, of course not. It seemed like there wouldn't be enough to have it spread out through the entire film. So I chose just to stick with the artifacts from the time.
The building is amazing. And you detailed a lot of things that aren't even there anymore, particularly on the outside of the building. Tell us about that.
Well, on the outside of the building, there was huge statuary groups. Around the upper floors, there was a giant statue, which I should know the exact dimensions, but it eludes me now. There's a giant statue with two small children, and that was really iconic of what he was trying to do. You know, it symbolized trying to protect those who couldn't protect themselves. And then there were other things like eagles, and there was cherub head. Like at the top, there was like little cherubs with like holding reefs, and they eventually, I think they cut the heads off the cherubs because they're afraid they're going to fall. You know, towards the end of the 30s, stuff started to fall off there, so they just removed everything.
Now, comparably speaking, if someone were trying to do something like that, adjusted for inflation and architectural standards, there'd be a lot of people poo-pooing it. You can't do that. We can't afford it. It's too much. We don't need it. Blah, blah, blah. Were there naysayers at the time?
There were definitely naysayers. There were state laws in the books that an insurance company couldn't spend so much of its capital on a building because they were afraid it would, you know, threaten the solvency of the company. And, you know, so there's a big lawsuits that were going through the city or like through state court, and then it actually went to federal court. But eventually all these lawsuits were defeated and they built the building, and it's like, yay, look at us. We defeated all these lawsuits. Rights on our side. We're going to build our building. Our company's going to be great. The irony was, you know, they probably should not have built the building.
Right, because it was the downfall of the company.
Yeah, it was definitely the downfall.
It stayed up, but the company fell down.
Yeah, within a decade, the company splits itself from the fraternal society to a regular company, and it starts to distance itself from the building itself, being like, well, we don't own property like that fraternal society of similar name. We're another company that owns no real estate.
And was this Lentz?
No. By this time, Lentz had died he died in 31. So it was just a few years afterwards. So it was the people who came in after him.
Yeah. And when things were falling apart, did you learn whether or not it was just bad management of the company or of the union?
I never really found anything specific to that. I know I found some letters from, you know, there's a giant pipe organ that was in the lobby, and there was like letters from their museum that's still around that's talking about they weren't paying their bills. They basically couldn't, you know, they'd put this organ in there and it took them forever to pay it off, and they were being super slow. Like there's basically physical threats, you know, between fighting the American Insurance Union lawyer because they weren't paying their bills.
What has changed the most? We talked about the outside of the building. What do you recommend after doing all the research and producing this documentary? What do you recommend people go and make sure they see at the Levesque Tower?
The best, in my opinion, the most visually interesting thing that still harkens back to that original era is like the elevators in the lobby. You know, other than that, most of the stuff's been gutted. I've been given a pretty extensive tour throughout the building and the inner workings, and there's almost nothing left from the original. At one point, there was a scaled-down replica of the Hall of Mirrors from Versailles.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's gone. Like, and I know I consulted with the author who did a book on this too, and nobody knows what happened to that. It's just gone.
The big medallion on the floor as you enter, that's still there, it's different.
Yeah, it's still there. Originally, you know, it's the American Insurance Union logo with the AIU initials in the center. And then they pulled, when Levesque and Lincoln took over, they pulled that out and put an LL. But other than that, everything else is exactly the same. And on that, it has all this weird, you know, the astrology of when the cornerstone of the building was laid. You know, so if you look at it, you can see little star positions. And yeah, it's just, who does that in architecture anymore? Talked about, you know, astrology and puts horoscopes in the lobby of a building.
Well, it was his way of imbuing it with some kind of meaning. People do it differently nowadays, I suppose. But why did you kind of stop when you did? It was sort of when, I think it was when Catherine Levesque bought it back.
Pretty much. I kind of stopped with the end of the company because to me, you know, I just wanted to explain what forces led to the building becoming. And I feel like most of the contemporary stuff people know, or it's out there, or there's all kinds of anecdotes about it that people know. But I just didn't think it was relevant for me to talk about that. You know, I kind of wanted to focus very deeply on the origin of it, and everything else people can kind of find already know.
We have an email from Alex, writes, our family moved to Columbus in 1964 when I was almost 6 years old, and I thought the Levesque Tower was the Empire State Building. It stood alone back then. It was right up there.
It's funny, Ken Burns' brother, Rick Burns, he's a documentary filmmaker too, and he did a great series on New York City. It's like a six 2-hour episodes, really amazing. And one of my friends pointed out, and I've even seen this while I've been doing this research, there's a shot in there of the Levesque Tower, but they think it's New York City, and it's quite clearly the Levesque Tower.
Mistaken for the Empire State Building.
Yes, yes. Well, I don't know if it's the Empire State Building, but they thought it was a skyscraper in New York City.
Okay. Seth Mockerman, he's a Columbus filmmaker. He wrote and directed Citadel, Birth of the Levesque Tower. It's a documentary. You'll be able to see it on Wednesday. Go to our website at WOSU.org for more information about that. When we return, we'll hear from an architect working on renovations and also a local historian. So stay with us. We're talking about the Levesque Tower. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Well, War correspondent P.J. O'Rourke thought he was too old to keep being scared stiff, so he retired and decided to travel for fun. The National Mall, family ski trips, a mountain horseback ride, and he discovered that pleasure trips were more frightening than an afternoon under artillery fire. I'm Neil Cunnan. Holidays in Heck. P.J. O'Rourke joins us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation is on our station from 2 until 4 right here on 89.7 NPR News. Partly sunny skies today and a high of 64 degrees. A few clouds tonight, a low of 46. Some sunshine for Tuesday, a high of 68. Right now, 54 degrees with cloudy skies.
Support for 89.7 comes from Ohio State's College of Arts and Sciences, announcing the 19th Annual Celebration Concert, a fast-paced holiday extravaganza, December 2nd in Mershon Auditorium. More at music.osu.edu.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking about the Leveque Tower today, the first skyscraper in Columbus and Ohio, for that matter. It was the fifth tallest building in the world when it was built in 1927. There's a new documentary about the building. For more information on the screening, go to drexel.net. We've been talking with Seth Mockerman, the filmmaker of the new documentary, The Citadel, Birth of the Leveque Tower. Joining us now is architect Robert Loversidge, Jr., the president and CEO of Schooley Caldwell Associates in Columbus. He is past chair of the American Institute of Architects National History Resources Committee and a recent recipient of the AIA Ohio's Gold Medal Award. He was a principal in charge of the renovation and restoration of Ohio's historic landmark State House and many other historic restoration projects. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Good morning.
Also joining us is Ed Lentz, local historian, WOSU commentator, and consultant for WOSU's Columbus Neighborhoods Project. He is the author of Columbus, The Story of a City, as it were, Stories of Old Columbus, and A Home of Their Own, The Story of Ohio's Greatest Orphanage. Welcome back, Ed.
Always a pleasure, Ann.
So, as the author of Columbus, The Story of a City, what sort of chapter do you devote to the Leveque Tower?
Well, it's integral to the beginning of the 1920s as sort of the image of the city is changing. I mean, there are some people out there who might submit to you that the Wyandotte Building was actually the first skyscraper in the city.
Remind me, which one is that?
Right across the street from the palace.
Oh, okay.
It's a classic building, and at the time it was built in the 1890s, it dominated the landscape, and it was part of that new generation of tall buildings that came into being about that point in time. And in the years that immediately followed, we'd see some of the others up at the corner of Broad and High, the Capital Trust Building, and that kind of thing. And then comes the tower, which just sort of is far and away in a whole league of its own, if you will, compared to anything that Columbus had seen prior to that time, in both form and style and size. The thing is gigantic compared to that, and it changes the image of the city, because from that point on, as you're coming into Columbus, whether you're flying into the great air harbor that the tower was supposed to be, or just looking at it from 20 miles out, it's for a long time, that was what you saw. You saw that building and not much else.
The architect for the Citadel was C. Howard Crane. He specialized in the design of ornate movie palaces in North America, which makes sense when you talk about the Palace Theater, but not necessarily about a Leveque Tower. Bob Loversidge, what do we know about Crane and why he was involved in this?
Well, he was a very popular architect at the time, but he's known very much for the theaters. And the very flamboyant kind of style of the times, I think, is reflected in the building. It's interesting to me that while he did this building for a very flamboyant owner, he didn't do the theater that's inside it. And I'm not sure what the story, maybe Seth knows the story of that, but it is an interesting anomaly, I think. But the building is very theatrical, and it's very much in the style of his work all over the country.
Anything else that he did in the city, Ed Lentz? Or was that his big wow thing, and that was pretty much it?
That's the one that comes to mind when I think of him.
There were questions at the time about the financial cost of the building, and we talked about that earlier with Seth Mockerman. Was there a one-upsmanship that began with that?
Well, you got to John Jay had a vision of what he thought Columbus should be and what he thought his company should be, and he sort of thinks about the two together. Now, he's also a fellow who sort of hedges his bets. We haven't really mentioned, I don't think, that, you know, there's a covered walkway that connects across through the Palace Theater mm-hmm. over into the Deschler Hotel. And part of the deal with the tower was that a good chunk of the lower section of the tower near the palace, you know, was hotel rooms, which gave you sort of a guaranteed income stream to help pay off the debt on the building. So he was, and he figured, you know, putting the building together with the theater was a pretty good idea at the high tide of vaudeville. And, you know, the palace is a jewel. There's nothing quite like it. It was built to be a vaudeville theater, as opposed to the Ohio, which was built to be a movie theater. And then later becomes all kinds of other things down the road. But you can still see, if you tour the palace today, I mean, it's a theater with its own hotel at the back of the theater, this kind of thing. Just an amazing building in its own right.
Bob, you are currently the lead architect for the Levesque Towers new ownership group.
Right.
Talk about, as you approach this job, about the engineering feat of a Levesque Tower in and of itself.
Well, the Levesque Tower was kind of an amazing structure at the time. It was, as you said, I think the fifth largest building in the country. It had deep caisson foundations, which hadn't been done here before.
Similar, describe what a caisson foundation is.
Well, a caisson foundation is where you have to dig a hole all the way down to bedrock and keep it dry and keep it clean and get the foundation very, very deep. It's a technique that was used for the Brooklyn Bridge when it was originally built. It was dangerous. Some people were killed during the process of building Levesque. So it was obviously got a lot of attention everywhere. The height of the building is no accident. It's 6 inches higher than the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C. And I was in Washington last week, and I was looking at that thinking, wow, that's the Levesque Tower. It's an incredible structure that clearly could be seen from all over, from all directions approaching Columbus. And so as an engineering feat, you know, things had been done like it before, but not here, and not here for a very long time. It was the tallest building on the horizon for many, many years.
In the documentary, it's noted that it took about 2 years to build it. That didn't seem like that long to me, but there was a note about how, or a mention that it took 2 years to build. That didn't seem like that long to me. Would that be necessarily that long in your book, Bob?
Buildings went up a little faster in those days, than they do today. I think that, first of all, they're simpler. It may not seem that way, but our buildings today are a lot more complicated. They have a lot more systems. They have a lot more regulation, a lot more people watching. So 2 years doesn't seem like a long time to me. In New York City, the Empire State Building went up very, very quickly. I forget what the timing on that was, like a year. So, you know, with steel construction and terracotta, which is the exterior material of the building, all preformed and made and shipped here, it was like putting up a giant erector set. And once they got out of the ground, it went pretty quickly.
Ed Lentz, 4 people died making the building.
Right.
As the building went up, what did people think of it?
Oh, I think the building was extraordinarily popular when it was opened, and people came from all over the Midwest to take a look at this building. It would sort of be, in a way, in an era before shopping centers, this was the new big thing to come down to Columbus and take a look at that and go up on top. I mean, I can remember when I came to Columbus in the 60s, one of the times I went downtown, you could go up to the observation tower at the top of the Levesque, where you looked at those fancy binocular things that sort of looked like big, I don't know what.
Insect eyes.
Insect, those guys, yeah. No, they had those up there, and you could basically look out in all 4 directions around the town for 50 cents. And I thought it was just a terrible day when they closed the observation deck at the close of the 1960s. But people did that for 40 years, you know, come to Columbus and go up on top of the building, just like they still do in a lot of buildings in other cities. It was a tourist attraction, without question.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the Levesque Tower, the first skyscraper in Columbus and Ohio, with Bob Loversidge. He is an architect and the president and CEO of Schooley Caldwell Associates, and also Ed Lentz, a local historian, author, and consultant for WOSU's Columbus Neighborhoods Project. And Seth Mockerman's with us, too. He's a Columbus filmmaker who wrote and directed Citadel, Birth of the Levesque Tower. Do you have a memory of the Levesque Tower? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Steve called in and left a message. He asked, did the building have a device to dock a blimp? The Empire State Building has something for this. Seth Mockerman?
I don't believe that it did. I think it was talked about doing things like that, but I've never seen anything about anything specific being installed for that reason. So, no.
It did have beacons, however, you know, the
lights
to let people know if they were flying by that the building was there.
Matt, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Well, thanks. I'm old enough to remember the Levesque Tower as the single skyscraper in Columbus. And in the, I want to say 80 or 81, I was on a bus and a fellow, a Middle Eastern fellow, had brought his guidebook from somewhere in the Middle East, and it was talking about the Hall of Mirrors and the elevator lobby of the AIU building and the observation deck. So it was from more than just the Midwest that people came. But the guidebook was from like 1959. So
a little out of date.
A little out of date.
Okay. Thanks, Matt.
You bet.
614-292-8513, or you can email us, as did Michelle, at allsides@wosu.org. Michelle writes, I grew up in southern Ohio, but my father lived in Columbus, and he would drive me up to Columbus to visit him once a month. I always begged him to drive me through downtown so I could see the big buildings up close. I was a bit of a country bumpkin. My favorite building was the Levesque Tower, probably because it looked so different than the other buildings, which were essentially giant boxes. My strongest memory is of one day when I was probably about 6 years old in the car with my father at night, approaching downtown from the south on 71 North, and I said out loud, that building looks like a French fry with melting cheese on it, referring to the lights around the top of the building. So for the last 21 years, the Levesque building has been the cheese fry building to me. Thank you, Michelle. Another way to visualize the Levesque Tower. From Veronica on Facebook, she says, I was born in 1961. My dad drove us downtown to see it. It stood out then. Later as a teen, my friend and I went up to the top floor as far as permitted, which was the thing to do at the time. Very cool, but we were in the interior only. I still like how they light up seasonally, such as a cross and sometimes colored pink for breast cancer awareness. I can't wait to see the documentary. Thanks a lot for those messages. 614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call, Ed Lentz, how did it change the neighborhood?
How did the building change the neighborhood?
Yeah.
Around it,
you mean?
It was starting a process, I think, of expanding the downtown. You have to, if you want to step back a little bit, just before the time of the Levesque, that section of downtown from the corner of Broad and High down toward the river was really the heart of the old theater district. There were theaters in other parts of town as well, but that was the area that had one theater right after another. And the Palace is sort of a reminder of that in a way, but what you see happening with the buildings like the Wyandotte across the street and the Tower coming in, this area that had once been sort of the, two-story to three-story entertainment district is now becoming part of the heart of commercial downtown. Sort of downtown is moving off of High Street and out the adjacent streets out Broad in either direction, in fact. You know, and you can still see that process all the way down through the 20th century as we see more high-rises begin to move out East Broad Street as well. So Columbus's scale, its urban scale, if you will, really begins to change in earnest in that part of town with the arrival of the tower.
Bob Loversidge, what have been the big changes to the building that are notable structurally but as well as just visually?
Well, I think the biggest change was after the Deschler-Wallach Hotel was demolished, which I think was about 1970, the 600 rooms, hotel rooms that used to be in the lower part of the building were removed and replaced with offices. So functionally, the building changed dramatically at that time. The lobbies were redone. The lobby that we think of today along Broad Street was added. There hadn't been a lobby there because all of those hotel rooms are accessed from the hotel, from the bridge that I had mentioned earlier.
You mean where the medallion is on the floor?
No, further east, where there are four big aluminum archways and revolving doors, where you go into a rather modern-looking lobby. All of that was added. Previously, there had just been stores there, storefronts along Broad Street. The main lobby where the medallion is was really for the tower, for the upper part of the tower, which was a relatively small office building for AIU that was sitting on top of this rather large hotel. 600 rooms is a big hotel, so most of the building changed use after the hotel was changed. So on the outside, we've seen those changes along the storefronts and the first floor. Some of the sculptural elements that Seth mentioned earlier were removed. The big groupings of the man holding the children and protecting them were removed, I think about 1949, and either because they were falling apart, which is what I've read in some places, or because they blocked the view from the offices that were behind that, which I've read in other places. I don't know which is really true, but the terracotta probably was deteriorating by that time. The whole outside skin of this building is made of glazed terracotta, which is like brick, only large pieces, and made to look like oak bark. It's called called oak bark.
Which explains
terracotta.
So much now.
Exactly, right. and it's a brittle material. And one of the things that we didn't know about tall buildings in the 20s was that they move a lot. And so these tall buildings didn't have expansion joints and didn't accommodate the weather in quite the way that we would do if we were building it today. So one of the things that's changed over time is just a loss of some of the detail. But from a distance, you don't really notice that. It's when you get up close that you start to see the damage.
And it was struck by lightning, right, Seth?
It was struck in lightning, yeah. And a big chunk of it fell down and hit a car sitting down below. So
I think it was a police car.
Yeah. Well, the one thing I wanted to say about the white oak is there was actually a reason for that as well, because they say specifically it's a white oak. And if you look on the facade near the entrances, there's also pictures of a oak tree. And I've talked to a few people and I've done some research, and the white oak is a symbol of longevity. You know, they really thought that what they were doing was going to last. So, they wanted their building to symbolize that and just about every detail they could imagine. So I think that's why they chose that to make, specifically pattern the texture of the building after that tree.
Ed Lentz, was the building ever at risk of demolition?
No, I don't think so, really. The building was still very well occupied well through the 60s. And by the time we get down to the era of modern preservation, with the emergence of groups like the Columbus Landmarks Foundation, which Bob Leversage helped bring into being along the way, and which, in terms of full disclosure, I should mention I've been associated with for a long time, and who also was associated in helping Seth make this film. From that point on, the tower begins to lose occupants. It loses some tenants along the way, and it begins to lose its sort of centrality, if you will, as the dominant building, especially when some of the newer ones come along, in those years of the 1970s and 80s and so on. But by that time, there's an active preservation movement in town who's very much interested in ensuring that this building survive. So in that sense, the building acquires something of a constituency, if you will, as does the palace, as do a lot of the neat buildings around downtown.
Sharon, you're on the air from Canal Winchester. Welcome to the show, Sharon.
Hi. I was listening to it, to Ed Lentz talk about it, and my grandfather, Leroy Sweeney, was a plumbing engineer. He worked for Huffman Wolf Plumbing Company. And my mother and her brothers have told the story that Grandpa was called in to redo all the plumbing in the Leavitt Lincoln Tower. There was something wrong with the whole building. So he went in and drew new plans and supervised the installation of the new plumbing.
And when was that?
In the early 30s when it was being built. I think it was completely built and something went wrong, so they brought in Grandpa Sweeney asked him to do it. He was an engineer in plumbing.
That's definitely a big oops moment.
Yeah. I hate it when that happens.
Lucky for your grandpa, Sharon.
Yes. Yeah. We're all very proud of that.
Thanks a lot for your call.
All right. Bye-bye.
We're talking about the Lincoln Leavitt. Well, it's known as the Leavitt Tower now. If you have a memory, some info you want to share about it, that's what we're talking about. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In 14 years on Saturday Night Live, Daryl Hammond did many impressions, including Bill Clinton.
I rehearsed it with a southern accent, and then I put in this little crackle in my voice.
Few of the cast members knew Hammond struggled with drink, drugs, and self-cutting as a result of childhood abuse. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Daryl Hammond. He has a new memoir.
And Fresh Air begins later today at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Signs begins with an update on Ohio's congressional redistricting. And then later in the hour, mediation to prevent violence. Join us for those discussions on All Signs with Ann Fisher at 11 o'clock on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from Marburn Academy, a forward-thinking school for ADHD and dyslexic students, hosting an open house Monday, November 14th at 7 p.m. More information at marburnacademy.org.
54 degrees in downtown Columbus with cloudy skies. Partly sunny skies today, a high near 64. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 46 degrees. Sunshine for Tuesday and a high of 68. A few clouds Tuesday night, a low of 50. And then some rain on Wednesday, a high of 60. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Today on All Sides, we're talking about the Levesque Tower, the first skyscraper in Columbus and Ohio. It was the fifth tallest building in the world when it was built in 1927, 6 inches taller than the Washington Monument. There's a new documentary about the building. For more information on a screening of it this week, go to Drexel.net. We've been talking with Seth Mockerman, the filmmaker of a new documentary, The Citadel, Birth of the Levesque Tower, also with us. Architect Bob Loversidge, Jr., the president and CEO of Schooley Caldwell Associates, and Ed Lentz, local historian, author, and very, very helpful with WOSU's Columbus Neighborhoods Project. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I want to get to some of the calls, but first I want to talk about the ownership of the building and how it's changed over time. Ed, can you help us out with that?
Well, essentially, the American Insurance Union gambled, to make a long story short, that the extraordinary economic success of the 1920s would go on forever. People actually believed such things back in those days. And so they made an enormous speculative investment in this gigantic structure, and the Depression came along. Easiest way to put it in a few words, and the company found itself unable to support itself or the building and eventually lost control of the building and then would be picked up by a partnership of mostly consisting in the Levesque interests and eventually totally within the purview of the Levesque interests. And that has been the situation. It's going to be, hence it comes to be called the Levesque Tower, until relatively recently. In the last few years.
So, Bob Loversidge, who owns it now and what are their plans? What are you doing?
Well, the current owner's a company called Tower 10 LLC. It's an investment group headed by Bexley resident Bob Myers and also a group headed by Don Casto. So familiar
local
names, local control, local investors. They are very excited to be stewards of this building. You know, it's gone through a couple of out-of-town landlords that maybe have treated it like an out-of-town asset, and this group really wants to make it right. And the primary focus of our work right now is trying to solve mysteries. We're still trying to find out more about the hotel, more about the lobbies and the first couple of floors. If there's anybody out there that can really tell me about the Hall of Mirrors, I'd like to hear from them. I'd like to know what happened to the great stained glass window that was in the building. But what we're trying to do at the moment is work on the public spaces, the first three floors. If you drive by the building today, you'll
the
see scaffolding,
the mezzanine
level,
okay,
and the connection to the garage and the lobbies. And primarily right now we're working on the first three floors of the outside of the building. We're going to take out the aluminum storefronts that were put in the 1970s and put back some very interesting new pieces. We're going to replace the entrances, which are tired and don't work very well. the sidewalks, the whole streetscape. You know, this building from a distance looks fabulous. Up close, it's kind of a gray building sitting on a gray street on a gray sidewalk, and there's nothing green. And so we're trying to put it back into the kind of place that it should be. And that'll be a prelude to a lot more work inside the building over the years.
Marianne in Columbus, you want to talk another mystery, the ghost in the elevator?
Yes, and actually, I've been in the Black Tower for 23 years now. I was on the 13th floor when you were with the Blade, actually.
That's right. I was on the 13th floor, right.
Yes, yes. But two things. One is, has Ed come across any stories of the ghost who does ride the elevator sometimes? And do you have any stories from the old days of the press club? And I'll take the answer offline.
Thanks. Thanks, Marianne. Ed?
Well, Ann, you probably have better stories about the press club than I do, because I was only an occasional visitor
there.
Yeah, but I don't
talk about them on the air. But what about that ghost in the elevator?
Any other we want to discuss today?
Those old press club stories.
Yes, there's a rumored ghost that's supposed to wander up and down the elevator. I have not met that particular ghost.
Me either.
You may recall that Columbus Landmarks does a ghost house tour and so on and this kind of thing.
But sometimes it was kind of creepy outside the press club, now that I recall.
Well.
Is it still there, the press club?
No.
Okay.
No, it's not. Yeah. Any building, large building, that's had any kind of a tumultuous history, and that building certainly has over the years, develops its own legends and ghosts and that sort of thing.
If it doesn't have a ghost, it's kind of a loser of a building, actually.
But frankly, I haven't met a person in passing, so it's hard to say. Of course, I haven't met many of the ghosts of Columbus. I've met a lot of people who say they have from time to time. Makes for good stories. But,
Steve in Hilliard, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. I run the Early Television Museum in Hilliard. And one of the things that we acquired a couple of years ago was the original television transmitter for Channel 6. TV stations came on the air, three of them, in Columbus in 1949. Channel 6 decided to put their transmitter on the top floor, and their transmitting antenna on the building. Now, a few years later, they moved to a taller tower elsewhere. But we have the original transmitter, and I learned recently that normally the transmitters are made up of these racks of equipment that are about 2 feet wide, and there are about 20 of them. And normally, they're lined up in a row so they can interconnect them. But that wasn't possible when it was installed in the Leveque Tower, because there just wasn't a big enough space where they could put it all together. So one of the engineers that used to work on it told me that these racks of equipment were just sort of scattered around and interconnected with cables, which I would think would be sort of dangerous because there were really, you know, high voltages involved in this stuff. But anyway, I thought I'd pass that along.
Okay.
Well, I can tell you for a fact, up there on top of the tower, when you get up there, there's a little balcony up there that runs around the whole building at the top level and gives you access from that balcony to the area he was just talking about, where the radio transmitters and TV transmitters and where radio antennas still are to this day. And on that balcony, the wind is pretty stiff, and there's nothing in the way. That balcony is basically a little bit less than waist high. It's a lot of fun.
Still some equipment up there. They've told us not to spend, not to be too close to it for too long. We don't want to get microwaved.
There was a period of time, wasn't there, when those big lights at the top were turned off?
Yeah, for a while.
It seems to me when I moved here in the late 80s, it was turned off, and there was much ado about them being turned back on.
Yeah.
Jim, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Hi. I just wonder if any of your guests are aware of what is called the skyscraper indicator, and how much the Leveque Lincoln Tower was kind of part of that, and actually smarter than the guys in New York, because they started building the Empire State Building closer toward the end of the Roaring Twenties, and even before they finished that, the Great Crash on Wall Street happened, and the Depression. But so they built the Leveque Lincoln in 1927. The Roaring Twenties have been going on long enough that they had enough hubris to want to put something like this together.
Ed Lentz, you want to take a swat at that?
Yeah, as I think we mentioned, this is the age of ballyhoo, and people are basically, the tower isn't alone, either here in Central Ohio or across the rest of the country. This is an age in which many people, rich, poor, and in between, feel that the American economy has finally come of age, that the economy seems to be going nowhere else but up, and with the, should we say, modest problem of prohibition sitting out there as a, you know, sort of side note to all of this, economically, the 1920s seems to be a very good time. And you see a lot of expansion of a lot of major construction across the city here, as well as across the country. It's a confident period, without question. And if we look back at it today, it's easy in hindsight to see where the weaknesses were in that economy that would ultimately lead to the Great Depression. But frankly, if you read a lot of the people who were writing at that time, they just didn't really see it. They didn't see it coming.
Thank you, Jim. Dave in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Yes, thank you. I have three anecdotes to add.
Okay.
My mother was expecting me the same year that the tower was built. We have a mutual birthday, 1927.
Uh-huh.
And she used to travel to work by streetcar past the tower. And the day that they had a number of fatalities due to gas exposure in the subterranean area of the tower, she saw them removing the bodies. She always related that story to me. Uh-huh. Second thing is, I was a member of the press club when it was there, and I think on leaving the press club, a number of people saw visions and things that they imagined on the elevators and had all kinds of experiences.
Elephants and things.
also, a very good friend of mine, John Frame, lived at the top of the tower and had a broadcast from up there on WTVN at that time.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Lived up there and gave his morning broadcast from the tower. Those are the three things I wanted to add. Well, I'll just hang up and listen to your comments.
Well, thanks for calling, Dave. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Yeah, there was we had an email from Gloria mentioning John Frame living in the Levesque and broadcasting his WTVN radio program from his apartment. Who else has lived in the Levesque? Bob or Seth or Seth?
Was it the CEO of Miracle-Gro who's there now?
I think so.
Yeah.
Scott.
Jim Hagedorn?
Yeah. I was up when I was filming all the B-roll around the top of the tower. They actually let me in there because they were doing renovation, so he wasn't there yet. And that's an amazing
space. It's an amazing space.
Well, I was going to say, what does it look like?
It's two stories high,
uh-huh.
And it's all glass. I mean, it's at the very top of the tower. The only other residence that I'm aware of is that Mrs. Levesque has a sort of an apartment She doesn't live there, but I mean, it's a place where she can entertain.
It's a good size apartment because that's where we had our fundraiser last fall there.
Right.
So, yeah, it was really nice space.
About how many square feet are we talking?
Gosh, I'm really bad with square feet. It's definitely not huge. And it's funny because, you know, older buildings, you know, are smaller. So when you walk in there, it feels a little more claustrophobic just because the ceilings aren't very high. You'd expect a penthouse to be huge, but it's certainly not.
It's not huge because it wasn't designed that way. That was added much later.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah from Dublin wonders if why the observation deck was closed and whether or not it could be functional again. Bob Loversidge?
I suppose it was closed because there were higher buildings or it was no longer popular or they wanted the space for something else. I don't know. We haven't really talked about the top of the building yet, so I don't know whether it would be in the cards to open it up again or not.
Well, is it because, you know, because all the there's so much transmitter equipment, the stairs leading up, like CB's transmitters up there.
Well, and there's lots of issues with regards to egress and codes and that sort of thing.
Well, the major problem was that the access elevator to the observation deck was a separate elevator that one had to get into after leaving the main elevators a few floors below. And that little elevator, for anybody who's ever been in it, is pretty small.
It's like a very small closet.
And part of the problem with the observation deck was that you had a lot of people in a very small elevator. And it got to be both a security, safety, as well as convenience issue with the owners of the building. It was just getting to be a pain in the neck. And that's why, my understanding is, that's why they made the decision to just let it go by. And you know, there were other big buildings coming on as well at that point in time that did have observation capabilities.
You know, lots of buildings over time in Columbus have had observation decks, including the State House and the Blind School, the Deaf School, and Any building with a tower at one time had an observation deck.
Yeah. Jenny from Columbus, she asks, did I dream this or was there once a big King Kong balloon on top of the tower? I don't know. And she also remembers Frame living there. Does anybody remember King Kong balloon?
I feel like I've heard that story before. I don't think I've seen a photo of it, but I feel like that's been mentioned to me before in the course of working on this.
Chuck from Columbus writes, I moved to Columbus from Lansing, and the Levesque Tower often reminded me of the R.E. Olds Tower in Lansing. But not as – the Levesque was much higher than that, I think. Maybe not. I don't know. I'm shaking heads. So, all right, Chuck, thanks for the email. What – Ed, do you remember the first time you went into the Levesque? Or do you remember the first time you saw it as a historian?
Well, I remember the first time I ever saw it was when I was a child, and I grew up in southwestern Ohio, and we used to come up through here in the years before the freeway. You came into Columbus on U.S. Route 40, the National Road, which is Broad Street, and I can still remember when I was a kid in those days. We'd come into town and be relatively late at night. My father had this thing about trying to figure out the timing of the lights so that you could try to start out about where Westland is today and see if you could make it to Broad and High without having to stop for a light. This was an art form to doing this. You had to go you went about 27 miles an hour. And if you did that consistently, you could beat the lights and sort of cruise into downtown. And if you're a little kid, you look up and your nose is pressed against the window, and crossing the Broad Street Bridge, here is this incredible building. That's my first memory of that building when I was about 6 or 7 years old. And I didn't get inside the building till I came up here to go to school in the 60s. And you walk into that building for the first time and take a look at that elevator bay with the brass astrological signs and the, you know, the big brass plate in the floor, and the painting that replaced the lost stained glass window as you're looking up the stairway toward the Hall of Mirrors, which doesn't exist either anymore. But still, it's an incredible place.
Thanks so much, Ed, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Ed Lentz, local historian, author, and consultant for WOSU's Columbus Neighborhoods Project. Also, Seth Mockerman wrote and directed Citadel, Birth of the Levesque Tower. Seth, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
And Robert Loversidge, Jr., he's architect and president and CEO of Schooley Caldwell Associates. Bob, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.